capitalism rests on a simple bargain. Investors provide capital, boards steward it, and companies create value. But the bargain only works when it is in communication. Without dialogue, trust erodes.
The right question is, does more engagement make companies better? More engagement is louder, longer, and more exhausting.
The absolute takeaway, yes, it probably isn't more, it is better. And I think that's probably why the proposers won the day.
Welcome to Inquire, the Investor Relations podcast. In this podcast, we speak with senior IR professionals on their career experience to share knowledge and learnings around IR strategies. We also speak with portfolio managers and sell-side analysts to explore their view of investor relations and what constitutes best practice.
As a brief note, I'll be on maternity leave over the coming months, so episodes will be published at a slightly reduced frequency of around once a month during this period, and we look forward to returning to our normal bi-weekly schedule later in 2026. In today's interview, I'm delighted to be joined by James Ashton, Chief Executive of the Quoted Companies Alliance, the industry body representing the interests of UK small and mid-sized quoted companies. James joined the QCA after more than two decades as a leading financial journalist, including as city editor and executive editor of the Evening Standard and the Sunday Times, where he interviewed many of the UK's most prominent business leaders. Today, he leads the QCA's work in advocating for a more supportive environment for growth companies, engaging with policymakers, regulators, and the wider market on governance, reporting, and market structure. Welcome to the podcast, James, and thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me, Clara.
So let's start by briefly understanding your background and experience. You spent more than two decades as a financial journalist before moving to the Quoted Companies Alliance, or QCA. So what prompted that transition from observing and commenting on markets to representing companies within them?
Yeah, well, I think the opportunity came along, I think, is the main thing. I mean, I'd been in newsrooms for, as you say, for a while, and different papers, Daily Mail, Sunday Times, Evening Standard. I'd actually worked for myself for quite a while and doing different things. There was writing, I did some books, I had a podcast, I joined a board. And as some of the stuff I was doing was conference facilitation, and it's actually through that that I got to know the QCA. And I was teed up to chair their 2022 conference, and it was at that point that Tim told me he was retiring. So the conversation ensued from there. As I said in the interview, and it must have been one of the things I got right, look, this is, I think, a good trade body, a good members organization is about telling stories. So please hire the journalist.
And you've obviously interviewed lots of CEOs and chairs and board members during your career. Is there anything you've learned about what differentiates companies that communicate well with the market from those that don't?
Well, I think it's really interesting because every CEO wants to be the one, like, I mean, look at Alex Baldock recently at Currys. You know, he announces he's leaving and the shares fall. And I think also you want to be like a Paul Polman figure. If you go back in time at Unilever, I remember it took someone with the confidence and standing of Paul to say, actually, we're not going to do quarterly reporting anymore. Just trust me. And actually the market laps that up. So I think it is interesting how they exude confidence. I think the best leaders have the purpose, authenticity, and delivery. They've got to be a bit likable, a broad vision, that ability to inspire those around them, and then lead people where they've never been before, which is the future. So all of that. And I think then there's that balance between you do need the strong kind of front person, but I think there's also got to be that element of team around them as well, so you don't kind of worry. And you bundle that all up, Clara, and I think it is about confidence, isn't it? Confidence internally and confidence externally, and probably confidence to be able to tell that story to the journalist that rolls in one day as well.
Having a good IR team as well to be the...
Obviously.
For the IR messaging on behalf of the management team. So let's take a closer look at the role of the QCA. So just for those less familiar, how would you describe that role in the UK market ecosystem today?
Well, we champion public companies, particularly mid-cap and small-cap. We're a trade association, a members body. We're actually debating internally how we described ourselves recently. So we want to help those companies to thrive and to fulfill their potential by using the UK market. So there's absolutely a lobbying, campaigning role to emphasize what they contribute to the UK economy and the changes and improvements they might need to do better. I think also from the membership point of view, there's an educational piece. We haven't got all the answers, but we want to be able to network those companies together. And there's things we've added, like a director's briefing recently, like a one-hour webinar if you're a director of a company. Watch this. This will tell you things about policy, governance and regulation, and you'll be forewarned and forearmed going into your next board meeting.
What are the most consistent challenges that you're hearing from your members right now?
I think the thing that still comes through, and you see this sometimes in the delisting statements from the smallest companies who decide to leave the market. You also see it when, you know, some of them succumb to the private equity takeover. It is the balance. We know that going public involves cost, involves some complexity, and we broadly think there's lots to be gained from being on the market. But I think it's that balance, the cost and complexity versus the benefits. And I know some companies have questions around the liquidity and the visibility versus the cost they need to incur to get there. So I suppose we would press on rebalancing that system and making sure that that can work, not just for AstraZeneca and HSBC, but for all companies. Because I do think London, and there's been so much focus, as you will know, Clara, on this capital market reform over the last 5 years. But there's something unique about London. It is a home to the mega caps and the micro caps. Not every capital market around the world can manage that. New York certainly can't. So I think if that's what we want to preserve, and we think you should, and you have to think, well, what are the conditions we need for that to continue and thrive?
I agree. I have quite a few fund managers on the podcast, and the consistent theme around London as a listing venue is the credibility that is attached to being a listed company on London, the governance standards and scrutiny that companies and boards are held accountable to as a result of that. But you're right, it's heavily balanced right now against valuations, which are under pressure from lots of fund outflows in the markets, and the cost, therefore, of being a public company is higher proportionally to a lot of companies' market caps. So there's a balance that boards need to consider, particularly when there's a lot of takeover and activism sort of interest in UK listed companies currently. And obviously it's a very broad remit with the QCA across both the membership responsibilities and policies. So where are you, any particular area where you're currently focusing efforts, where you feel you might have the most impact in today's markets?
Yeah, I think there's a number of strands of work. If I pick out, you know, audit, for instance, I mean, I think over the last year or so, we've had some impact around audit. Clearly, the FRC has driven audit quality up. That's been very much a focus for them. And one thing that we emphasized in a report a year or so ago was audit quality is great, but what about audit cost? And what about the availability? So availability and affordability, and how the cost of auditors has gone up. And actually, in some cases, companies have to try really hard to get that tender going. So we've put that out. The FRC have focused on smaller company audit. They put out some guidance stuff recently, and that's a good outcome, but it's by no means the end. We were disappointed that the government scrapped the draft audit and corporate governance bill. We do think that the public interest entity structure needs looking at. We think that skews the market. So we will carry on pushing on in that area. I think really it's a big year for capital flows. Everything looks better if the companies have liquidity and there are sufficient buyers and sellers. As you say, valuation is a thing. It's the companies looking to market. We'll look at the valuations of those stocks that are already there. And it's not surprising that some companies can be a bit disappointed and throw in the towel when the offer comes in if they are not being valued. And we know, even though there has been some delistings, there are fantastic companies based all over the UK doing great things. So I think on the capital flow, it's around pensions. We are quite relaxed about UK pension mandation as a backstop. It's only a backstop, and it only needs to be used when we've solved this problem. The problem being we're the second biggest asset management center in the world, and our assets are not backing our great prospects. So we need to think about however we do that, unite those two sides together. And ditto on the retail side, you know, very happy for ISAs. I think the simplest model for an ISA, go back 40 years, it's almost exactly 40 years ago that Nigel Lawson launched them as PEPs, a UK product for UK savers backing UK companies. And I think we don't need to underwrite investment in NVIDIA. I think Jensen Huang's probably okay on his own.
Couldn't agree more. And just on the kind of equities allocation point, UK equities active equities has fallen from over 50% of asset allocation to 4% today, but I think there's still a perception that active equities management in the UK is much higher. So there's a bit of a disconnect there between perception and reality, but I'm supportive of any sort of government or policy intervention to try and drive increase in ownership of UK equities.
Yeah, I agree. One point to make, I think, I trace back to day one was, I think it was November 2020 when Rishi Sunak as Chancellor stood up and said, we have a problem with UK capital markets, and he appointed Lord Hill and so on. I think the continuity we've had from government to government and goodness knows how many city ministers has been really helpful. I think where this government are in pooling pensions is a good step. We need to make sure that pooling and that larger pension pools actually mean they will take more risk and actually mean that they will get to UK equities. So we think there's still some joining of the dots to do, but directionally, I think it's pretty good.
And you've touched on some of the challenges facing UK listed companies, particularly small caps where liquidity is a challenge and valuations are under pressure. Any other thoughts just before we move on in terms of what else could be done to improve the attractiveness of the UK public markets?
Well, I mean, if I'm thinking about those smallest ones, and our members are from 3 million market cap to 1.5 billion, we're up to and including the FTSE 250. More than half the companies that trade shares in London are sub 100 million market cap. So we are a small cap market. We must celebrate that and think what would happen if all of those 50 million market cap became 100 million and what they would do to the regional economies. I think we have to think about what we really want. It's been made difficult for some of those investors that want to invest in small cap to actually do that. They're sometimes having to sell to cover redemptions. We've recently fed back to a piece of FCA work, liquidity risk management. You know, we think actually it's quite unsympathetic for those companies and those investors. And we know that institutions that probably were buying into stocks at 50 million market cap, say 6 years ago, pre-Woodford, probably coming in at 150 or nearer 200 today. And those initiatives that kind of could benefit, things like Mansion House Accord, are not really hitting the target for AIM and ACWIS companies, which is what they were designed to do as a Mansion House Compact going back, I think, almost 3 years. So more to do. And obviously tax reliefs are changing there as well. And we think some of that is very unfortunate. And those are things that we've pressed on recently with Treasury.
So we're recording this just after the QCA city debate. So it's the end of March and the debate took place last week, which is the 25th of March. And Equatoria was delighted to sponsor this event alongside Rathbones and Board Intelligence. And I'll just touch on the event format because I think it's a really differentiated event for the city. It's free to attend for both members of the QCA and non-members. And instead of your traditional panel of experts sharing views, the event takes place as a debate. So there are two proposers and two opposers of a particular motion. It happens once a year. And I'd really encourage our listeners to check out the event in terms of the coverage of the event that just happened, but actually consider attending the event because it is very differentiated in my view. The format really encourages the audience to participate, to be involved and share their views on the motion in hand. And it also emphasizes the importance of listening and giving consideration to different perspectives. So I think it resonates very well when we think about good board governance, particularly around the importance of being open-minded and willing to listen and challenge your own assumptions based on different perspectives. So in terms of last week's debate, the motion was boards need to do more to engage with investors, and obviously a very topical subject for Equatoria as an advisor to boards. So really interested, James, just in terms of what struck you most about last week's debate.
Well, thank you for supporting, first of all, Clara. You know, as you say, we do want this to be an event that's open to all, and we can only do that with sponsors. And the reason I was drawn to doing this is the second year we've done it, is that we want to make sure we're planting a flag in the City of London. We want to be, you know, at the heart of that debate and so on. And I think you're right. Everyone has been to panels for breakfast and panels in the evening over cocktails and so on. And I think a lot of people probably haven't been to a debate. It could be at school or university. And I think it's a really tight format. And actually what Barry Gamble, as the chair, I've got to get his title right or else he'll write in. I know he'll do that. What he has done with the four debaters is this is not a, you can sometimes turn up to a panel and be quite casual. in the language you're using and so on. I mean, they're all professionals, but they're very well drilled. They've thought about it a lot. So this is, it's quite a tightly presented event. And I think that, well, where we are in the world, to be able to actually entertain two sides of one argument, I think is a good thing for all of us. And then I think with the room, you know, this is good attendance, maybe 150 or so there, but there's such strong feeling. So there's a real sense of this stuff matters, which I think is always nice for us to have fed back to us and see that people care about public markets. And then the question of the day, the engagement with companies and investors, and a whole range of views as well. And I love the fact that the pendulum swings. It did last year and it did this year. What you thought you believe might change an hour later.
And I think just on your point about the audience, it's a great cross-section of capital markets attending. So we had board members, both executive and non-executives, presenting different perspectives in the audience, as well as a range of advisors and corporates represented, so PLCs in the room as well, sharing their perspectives on board engagement. And I think...
Yes, and actually that point about the engagement, sorry to interrupt, I mean, I think that we also got that, the variety of engagement, and this is quite a discussion point at the moment with the retail investment push coming in April and beyond, but we had institutional thoughts, but then we also had ShareSoc there with their views about what they want to see from a board.
Yeah, absolutely. So different representations across institutional and retail. And I'd say... perhaps the retail, so the representation was gearing more towards governance and the importance of including all investors when it comes to access to AGMs, when it comes to listening to the views of retail investors, which is an often overlooked but yet very important audience. And some frustrations expressed as well about the fact that some companies facilitate access to retail investors when they're doing capital raises, some don't, and it's not always broad-based across all retail broker platforms as well. So there were some really interesting views, I thought, around retail investors represented at the event.
Yes, no, I agree. And there will be more video and more and write-ups and so on that will emerge. But yeah, no, very thought-provoking. And the AGM point is a very live one. As you will know, I mean, that clarification on companies and virtual AGMs should come very soon from government.
The conclusion, I suppose, or my key takeaway from the event is, I'm sure the same for everyone attending, was that it's not necessarily about more engagement, but about better and more targeted engagement. And that way, boards are prioritizing still the importance of focusing on the company internally, the strategic direction of the business, while giving due consideration to all shareholders and demonstrating good governance through that engagement.
The right question is, does more engagement make companies better? More engagement is louder, longer, and more exhausting.
So just interested in your perspective, James, on the sort of thoughts presented as part of the debate.
Yeah, I agree. The backwards and forwards on actually the phrasing of the debate itself is quite a piece of work. And, you know, before we go public with that, and I think you had a little bit of the kind of a semantic battle about the meaning of the word more and how that was. But I don't think that affected the conversation. And the absolute takeaway, yes, it probably isn't more, it is better. And I think that's probably why the proposers won the day.
And obviously a key point I'd raise as Equatoria's representative is that obviously there is possibility to delegate some of that board communication. So obviously there are strategic times around AGM remuneration consultants that require involvement from the board and its non-executive directors, but companies have a much broader toolkit across in-house IR to delegate and outsource some of that communication. And I don't know if that's something you pick up maybe in some of the non-executive training courses you run at the QCA.
I think so. And I think the point was made on the night. It was interesting for me to hear that this is whoever thought they might have been doing that engagement before, whether it's the chair or head of Remco, obviously have quite a big job to do for a couple of months of the year. I mean, the sense was that this is clearly the advisors very, very supportive of that because it has to be that year-round effort, but where the other NEDs come in as well. I mean, really, this has to touch everyone.
Absolutely. And also, I think there's almost two facets to engagement with investors. You've got the governance piece where there's an element of sort of box ticking around making sure all investors are engaged to at the appropriate touch points. But then there's also the benefit of engagement more from an investor relations perspective to underpin valuation. And that was a point that was raised by the audience, I think, of the importance of actually engaging with investors, particularly non-holder investors, to access capital and brief those investors should a company wish to raise capital, which is the very important advantage of being a listed company. So I think there are sort of two perspectives there around both valuation and the importance of good governance for the audience to consider as well.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And the voting came in, so there was a big shift in sentiment. So before the debates, 75% of the audience were for the motion that boards need to do more to engage with investors, with 23% against and 2% abstaining. And following on from the debate, there was a 17 percentage point drop in support for the motion. So actually, we ended up with 58% support. So still in favour of boards engaging more and appropriately with investors, but a big shift. So the opposition, who had maybe the more challenging viewpoint to present as part of the debate, did a really effective job at convincing the audience around some of their arguments, which really focused around boards focusing inwardly on company performance, not being too short-termist and therefore not being too heavily influenced by market sentiment and volatility in a short-term basis for listed companies' share prices.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the opposers had a mountain to climb, but I think the combination of the former CEO, who's been to many, many investor meetings, more than we've had hot dinners, is really, really authentic from the front line, and couple him with the academic to add the numbers and the context. And I think they were a really powerful combination.
So moving on now to talk a little bit about the QCA Corporate Governance Code, which is used by the majority of AIM-listed companies in the UK. So what makes it particularly suitable to growth companies?
Well, we've been doing, the QCA code goes back in time a little bit. I mean, initially we were offering guidance on the UK code. And then it was in 2013 when we had what you might call a conscious uncoupling. And we started with our own code then, specifically for growth companies. And that has become, that has really found favor on AIM, on Aquis, and also now on the transition segment as well. So we're followed by more than 90% of AIM companies, and I think it's about 3/4 of Aquis companies. And we think it's pro-growth, it's flexible, it's a 10-point plan. And what we emphasize in all of our comms is this is a framework. It is not every point is applicable to every company. We did a piece of research recently which looked at the kind of first year's adoption of the 2023 version of the code. And we found that the proportion of companies applying the QCA code, a greater proportion are applying it flexibly, a greater proportion are deviating from one or more points. And this is about, it is not a tick box exercise. It's not black or white. It's actually holding this up against your company and using it as a guide with which to tell your story. So we were quite encouraged by the 20%. We have a lot of companies to move over from the 2018 code. We've said, look, that one is over now. This version has been out and been in circulation since November 2023. So it's time to move over. And there's a lot we're offering in terms of workshops and support for companies to come over to that. Of course, so much of that is included for QCA members. And not surprisingly, less of that is included for those that are not members.
And that's a really interesting point about applying the governance code flexibly. So where should companies feel more confident using comply or explain properly rather than defaulting to straight compliance?
Where? I think that's about their relationship with their investors and also guided by advisors and the board. I think it's very difficult for us. I mean, we publish and we look after it. It is ours, but we have never inserted ourselves in that conversation between companies and their investors. We think there should be some understanding from investors about the size of companies and their stage of growth. What was encouraging is that the deviation among the smallest companies on AIM is greater than that among the largest companies. So there is a sense that the application of the code grows with the company. What we really do need is more understanding from proxy agencies. We have, I would love to call this a close relationship. I don't feel that it is. We have found examples where the proxy agencies measure the governance of AIM companies against the UK code and in some instances against standards that they have created for themselves. So we think this is not particularly encouraging for companies, particularly for growing companies. I mean, actually coming into the orbit of a proxy advisor, you know, should be a positive for a growing company because it means you're suddenly at a certain scale. But actually, if you are being judged in a very kind of black and white kind of way with no real right to reply, then it isn't very positive. We have written to them all ahead of we know it's the first year of the new stewardship code. We know it's a transition year. We want them to just be reminded of their responsibility to support this market.
A really interesting point, and I think relevant to an IRO listening to this, because proxy agency engagement is actually a sort of year-round activity, but we too often see companies engaging either after the REM report has been published or just before, which doesn't always give enough time to engage. So there are opportunities throughout the year, particularly in quieter times, where IR teams have the possibility to start to brief and engage proxy agencies well ahead of any changes to remuneration that are touted, and that can be very supportive of engagement with those agencies.
I think that is, of course, no one wants to have that first engagement when the report has arrived, and I think there's kind of like the clock ticks down on the 24 hours before it's more widely distributed. I do think there's quite a number of companies in our membership who really find that engagement difficult at any time of year. And, you know, I think clearly there's a function they perform and they're really cognizant of their responsibility to their client, which is the investor. But I think without the company, the other point of that triangle being engaged in the process, the whole process breaks down.
I'm talking about engagement. The QCA has recently published a report looking at AGMs in the digital age. So can you share some of the key findings from the recent report that you published on the subject, particularly anything that was perhaps surprising about those findings?
Yeah, I think where we are, I mean, the government will soon, they've talked about it enough, they've flagged it a lot, Clara. They are going to say something wise about virtual AGMs. We have seen the largest companies move in the direction they think the world is going to go in, and AGMs have become more virtual, if you like. Perhaps there's all sorts of definitions in the report, whether it's virtual or hybrid or something. So I think there's a few points. I mean, we wanted to do that because there were questions being asked, and members came to us and said, well, you know, we're not quite sure. Some of the big companies are going virtual and can we do this and so on. So it's exactly where we would do a piece of research. And of course, no one had really pulled together the stats about the different formats of AGMs outside the 350. So that's a small cap, but also on AIM. And so we did that. We did a qualitative piece of work. We actually looked at what works internationally as well. And then we put together a few asks of government. And the first one is clarify, and you're testing me now, I think it's section 311. What does it mean? Can you actually be virtual? And it is amazing that we haven't got that yet. I think the surprising thing is, I mean, if you speak to the shareholder bodies, they will say, well, this is going to be a terrible thing. And companies probably just want to make life simple for themselves, close the doors, not have the shareholders in, engage with the larger institutions in the week or so before. And it's a cost-saving measure, isn't it? And actually, for a lot of the small companies, they are still quite eager to engage because where institutions have withdrawn, actually retail is a disproportionately important part of their share register. So 24% of AIM is retail, including directors. And then also the cost thing doesn't necessarily work. You have quite a lot of small companies. The AGM is a meeting. It is something to arrange. There is admin related to that, but it is probably just a handful of people in a lawyer's office, except those that make more of it and have a spread and presentations and so on. And one that springs to mind for me is MP Evans, which is one I went to last year, which was a sandwich lunch for more than 100. I think I wrote a post on it and said it felt like a cocktail party. So I think these are things, it depends how you use them. I think the point that we took away is that just as with hard copy or digital annual reports, we want to be in a position where companies can make a choice themselves. And it is for them to decide how they engage with their shareholders. And at any point, the shareholders can walk. But we hope that put a bit of color out there for what all companies are thinking, not just the largest, ahead of what the government is likely to do.
And of course, the research actually goes all the way up to FTSE 100. So it's a really interesting report for any public company listening to the podcast to delve into.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that is in there as well. But and I think what Ben did particularly well is drawing some of those strands from overseas. And it is interesting to note that we always think we're ahead, of course. But I think in this instance, it feels like we're behind. I mean, and notably markets like Norway and particularly Germany, where they where the virtual AGM is fine. But what they've baked into that is that companies need to seek approval from their shareholders. I think it's every 5 years in order to continue with a virtual model. And we think it would be very easy for us to say it should be virtual whenever, forever. But I do think we're always thinking about that engagement with the shareholders, not just because of the debate. So we've suggested something like that 5-yearly check as well. We just want the clarity as soon as possible because here we are going into another AGM season. And the legal advice would say, you can't do this. Well, actually, some big companies will do it regardless. We know they will.
So as we start to wrap up the conversation, we look ahead 5 years. What would success look like for the UK growth company ecosystem?
There's a number of things. I think one thing on the point of growth, because there is a, if I think about, you know, views across the all cap and sometimes views of the London market is success looks like if we have raised the greatest proportion of capital across Europe or we've had the most IPOs or whatever it is. I think of growth as how do we grow the absolute number of companies? That's been a real challenge. Clearly, there's a global trend where there are fewer public companies. I really think that we should see one measure of success as actually growing the pie, wherever those companies are traded, Aquis, AIM, the main market. But I would like to see us doing that. And I do think we have to really buff up this strong point of difference with New York. You've probably got to be, what, $2 billion market cap to even entertain IPOing in New York. And if you can do that as a much smaller entity here, and we can be, if London can be the capital of growth capital, if we're really marketing ourselves to all of those companies internationally, then I think that's a success. And we had kind of the restart of that back in December. You know, a couple of, there's a Dubai marketing company came to London. There was a auto diagnostics company came from US. So I think that's a success. I think another point is started using this expression capital agnostic. I'm not sure that will catch on, but what I mean by that is I do feel that we are, through whether it's the public interest entity regime or others, I think we are holding this relatively small band of public companies to ridiculously high standards when we think about the ownership structure, the capital formation behind the vast majority of companies in the UK. Why is there 60,000 more words in Sainsbury's annual report than Asda's? They've both got about 15% of the grocery market. They both employ about 150,000 people, and they'll both be a lot of trouble if either of them collapse. And it's purely because one is in the hands of a buyout firm and one is not. So I think we see all the pension money now is flooding into private. We don't see an associated increase in reporting requirements. So I do think we need to just step back and think, what do we actually need from these companies and what is just there because it's always been there? So I think to pair a lot of that back to have that level playing field would be a great success as well.
Really, really strong point there. And I couldn't agree more about reducing the length of some of the disclosure requirements, which have become quite onerous for public companies with not much value add from a sort of valuation perspective. And what role do you see the QCA playing in shaping that future?
Well, I hope we're trying to do it already, Clara. I mean, I hope we are, as I said with the debate, I hope we're a visible part of the conversation. I hope people feel they can't make changes to capital markets without bringing us in. We know the regular, we have, there's a good relation, whether relationship either with the government departments or with the regulators. And quite often the issue is they know that we are the easiest way of rounding up the views and opinions of all companies, not just AstraZeneca and BP or whatever. And in order for us to do that, of course, we need to still go out there and attract and retain members. And so that's what we're always looking for. These are ones that maybe can't walk into Treasury themselves. Maybe they've not got the time or they don't, just don't want to. But, you know, we're very happy to represent them. And we've made good inroads in the 250 in the last couple of years. And these are companies that can probably walk into Treasury if they want to. But I think they kind of like the cut of our jib and want to contribute to the work that we're doing.
And finally, what gives you optimism about the next generation of UK quoted companies?
If I start by talking about the current generation, and as I said, we know we've got fewer companies trading in London than we've had, but actually you look across the still huge community of them and you think, well, we've got one of these companies, at least one of these companies headquartered in every English county bar Herefordshire, got to work on Herefordshire. And you see the variety, whether it's fintech in Huddersfield or engineering in Wiltshire, there's all sorts of things. So I think there's great confidence in them. And then you do know that there are so many behind them. I won't go through all the arguments about wonderful universities and rule of law and that sort of thing. But we just know we keep creating them. I suppose we have to make sure that the markets here mean they can ladder up from small to large to international without losing their roots, without losing their listing.
Well, really interesting perspectives presented there today, James. And thank you very much for joining us today. It's been fascinating to recap on some of the themes covered in last week's debate and also to hear your perspectives on the QCA, your remits, your focus areas, as well as current topical market themes for UK quoted companies today. So really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. It's lovely talking to you.
And thank you for joining Enquire, the Investor Relations podcast. Please look out for our next episode,